How's this for purgatory? You're a refugee who can't go back to your old country, who hasn't been accepted in the new one, and who's warehoused on an actual island in Puget Sound. Into this situation comes Eleanor Hoag, who, at the time of this story, was a freshly minted lawyer ready to save the world. Her inexperience would turn out to be a bit of a blessing. If she'd known just how out of her element she was, she might not have had the guts to take on the system. The system, in this case, was U.S. immigration authorities against a backdrop of the geopolitics of 1980. KNKX reporter Paula Whistle brings us the story.
This is the temporary restraining order that,
Eleanor Hoag is showing me reams of old court records she's hauled up from her basement.
I can give you all these files.
I'm sitting on a red leather couch in her living room. There are big windows here with views of the surrounding woods. Eleanor had a long, successful career in corporate law, but these files scattered on a large coffee table between us are from a time before all that, when she was, in her own words, still a wet-behind-the-ears attorney. In 1980, Eleanor helped spearhead an effort to provide legal representation for hundreds of Cuban refugees who were being detained at the time at the federal prison on McNeil Island in South Puget Sound. To understand how and why they were there, you need to go back to what was happening at the time. Jimmy Carter was president.
As we meet tonight, it has never been more clear that the state of our union depends on the state of the world.
In the spring of 1980, boatloads of people fleeing Fidel Castro's Cuba began landing in Florida. President Carter said the U.S. welcomed them with open arms and open hearts. But then Castro responded. He called the Cubans who'd left scum and said he was going to empty out the country's prisons and mental hospitals and send them along too. The reaction was what you might guess.
Good evening. Politicians from several states tonight are sharply criticizing President Carter's handling of the Cuban refugee problem.
By the end, 125,000 Cubans arrived in what became known as the Mariel Boatlift. The overwhelming majority were not criminals, but the U.S. detained a small percentage they suspected were. That's how about 350 Cubans ended up at McNeil Island Prison. Now, this is where Eleanor comes in. She found out that the Cubans at McNeil were being rushed through their exclusion or deportation hearings without attorneys. Even though it's not required in immigration court, this, she says, just seemed wrong.
My thinking was, well, if they're going to have their exclusion hearings, then by gum, we're going to have them represented. But at that point, immigration was not such a hot topic, and there weren't all that many immigration attorneys.
But Eleanor had done some immigration work in law school, and her father was an attorney who'd worked with the ACLU. She says defending people's civil rights kind of came naturally for her. So she went to immigration and prison officials to get permission to meet with the detainees on McNeil. Looking back on it, she realizes everybody involved was way out of their comfort zone.
No one knew how to deal with the Cubans. There is absolutely no question about that. The prison didn't know how to deal with immigrants, and immigration didn't know how to deal with a bunch of prisoners. And even the Cubans didn't know how to deal with it. They were in a new setting. So everyone was really at odds.
How about you?
This was probably the one reason that I was able to get an in and push boundaries was because no one knew the rules.
The prison had been blindsided by the arrival of the Cuban refugees. Immigration was suddenly having to schedule all these hearings out on the island. And the Cubans who thought they'd be free in the U.S. found themselves shivering behind bars in an unfamiliar, damp climate. All of it was part of the broader national debate going on over the refugees.
This was like front page news, the boat lift and all of that, and you were a part of, you at the time, did you realize, wow, I'm a part of this history?
Yes, very much, yeah. And I think that made me feel pretty, cocky.
Eleanor helped recruit 100 lawyers and volunteer translators. She says having them on board meant they could slow down the hearing process. They could file appeals.
It was like putting molasses into the cogs of a machine. And immigration decided it wasn't so hot to keep the clients here.
But she says she had no idea how far immigration was willing to go to get the Cubans away from the pesky lawyers until one day when things took a very weird turn. Here's the story as she tells it. She arrives by boat on McNeil Island. She enters the prison, and the head guard reaches out his hand.
He shook my hand, as they always did, and there was a note in the handshake. So I...
Did it shock you at the time?
Yes, it did. But I went into the women's bathroom and read the note, and it said, they are about to transfer your prisoners. Please call me. I have evidence of this. Please call me at such and such a number. And don't call from your office. It's being bugged. It felt absolutely James Bondish. I just felt completely unnerved.
So that night, she goes to her father's house to call the guard.
And he said, if you want to stop the move, you have about 3 days before, and you could take this to federal court if you have a basis to stop them.
She sprang into action, corralling an attorney from her father's law firm who knew how to do this sort of thing. They worked day and night and quickly got a filing into federal court in Tacoma asking for a temporary restraining order to prevent the Cubans from being moved. They won. The judge issued the order, and the detainees were given the option of staying, where they had lawyers, or being shipped to a prison in Alabama. About 250 decided to stay. Immigration wasn't happy and continued to use some pretty hardball tactics. Without warning, they abruptly released several Cubans onto the streets of Seattle, sending a not-so-subtle message to other detainees that if they'd agree to give up their lawyers, they might get out too. But then it came out that some of the Cubans who'd been released had done time for some pretty serious crimes, like murder.
And they were keeping in prison a fellow who said that he had been convicted of stealing cookies. It was a really striking comparison.
The feds didn't appreciate the publicity, and Eleanor says they retaliated, even tried to get her disbarred. But the state bar said she hadn't violated any ethics rules. Within a year and a half, it was all over. The Cubans were gone. Most transferred to the prison in Atlanta. Very few ended up being released here.
That's where I become very uncertain about what good I did. I know that there are some that died in prison. There are some that were let out and committed crimes in the United States. And for that, I'm very, very sorry. I regret that, but that doesn't give the excuse to hold people indefinitely because you fear what they might do.
She says there's one lesson all of this taught her.
That you do stick your neck out and you may have regrets later on about how you did it, but that it's terribly important, if nothing else, for your own belief in your own system of ethics and morals.
But the whole experience did leave her with a lifelong distrust of immigration authorities.
I almost automatically think that they are not good people. And there are some very good people that work for ICE, I'm sure. But I don't give them the benefit of the doubt, and I will challenge them every step of the way.